I stayed in my den all evening, and late in the morning I went over to the house to attend the lecture, intending to leave immediately after the discussion following the talk given by the gentle friend. That day he lectured on nothingness, on becoming like nothing, and the happiness one derived from becoming like nothing. So the we were, what motive did he recommend for seeking a non-egocentrical conception of life? Happiness. The search for happiness. Not a word about the intense suffering of a man who feels one with all the joys and sorrows of the world. All he recommended was an escape from life, nothingness, and subsequent happiness, viz., the very height of selfishness. Before he withdrew, I looked at him fully for the last time. There was nothing in his eyes, voice, or bearing that could have provided any clue as to whether he really believed in the destructive things he had said or whether he was a mere tool. He may have been the latter. In most cases, apostles who are themselves deceived are very dangerous. It is easy to deceive people if the deceiver believes in his own message. I realized how dreadfully clever and adaptable the evil one is, and in how many different and cleverly disguised ways he carries on his soul-snatching activities. There is the appeal of wealth and power and the snare of excessive care for the needs of the body. Many people sell their souls to get them. Then there is the appeal of spiritual distinctions and paradises. The city of the initiates is a soul-snatching center of this kind. And for people who cannot be caught by either of the two, there are subtle philosophical systems. Decidedly the devil's shop is a well-stocked one, he caters for all possible tastes, and his snares are everywhere. The gentle friend had left the room and I listened to the discussion that followed. Is not the search for happiness in itself a selfish thing? Asked one of the hearers. He seemed to have taken up the objection I had mentally raised during the lecture. Yes, said another one. It is. Then there is a contradiction in all this, again observed the other. We want to be unselfish, and yet we are selfish in wanting to be unselfish. The other one hesitated for a while and then remarked, but I feel that my soul does not want it. J. want happiness, but my Sue does not want it. This remark strikingly illustrated the nature of the type of soul-snatching business carried on the mountain of simplicity, and how man's totalitarian consciousness can be split up by introspection and his soul subtly separated. My determination to do everything in life with my whole being and with intense soul passion became still greater. At top speed I left the mountain where the Pied Piper plays the tune of simplicity to catch souls. I marched 30 miles that day, hardly stopping to take food. When I sat down to take my lunch, which consisted of a handful of uncooked barley meal and a little water, I pulled out a piece of paper and wrote down the following sketch, the clever philosophers. Once upon a time there were clever philosophers. They did not believe in the Creator. We follow our own light, they said. And in all matters they only relied on the light of introspection. Then they came across the devil. What a monster, I said one of them. What a comfort to know that nothing is real and everything is a mere effect of ourselves. You are right, put in a second philosopher. Everything is subjective, nothing is objective. Then the devil opened his mouth and swallowed them. When they arrived inside the devil's body, the clever philosophers said with a superior smile, is it not obvious that we were right? The monster has disappeared. When I had returned from Asia, I found this piece of paper which had passed through the hands of several brigands and the inevitable soaking by rain and occasional spills. The sketch is an accurate picture of the mental condition of the circle of listeners on the Mount of Simplicity. They seem to ignore the polarity of good and evil. The same afternoon I saw one of the tall flying lamas whom I have described in my earlier book. Just after sunset I passed a place obviously used for cutting up corpses, which is the usual method of disposing of the dead in Tibet. The relatives hand the body over to the Lagpa and the latter to hands or corpsicussers. Carry them to a place usually marked by white stone slabs where the flesh is cut off and thrown to birds who gather for this strange meal when they see the Lagpa approach in the distance. Footnote. The flying lamas are called Lungampa, which, literally translated, means air meditation people or wind meditation people. End footnote. Sometimes the relatives accompany the funeral procession, but in many cases they do not do so, and the corpsicussers, who are often accompanied by a lama, are left to do their work unaccompanied by the relatives of the deceased. These places used for corpse cutting are a favorite spot for the sorceries and conjurations of the Tibetan tantrikas and nagpas. As I was in a great hurry, I did not want to lose time in going round the place in a wide circle. A few magicians were seated there and performed their strange rites with human bones from corpses whose flesh had been cut off recently. One of the sorcerers beckoned to me to keep far away, but since I had heard on the mountain that the district was being combed to find the white intruder, I was anxious to get to the abodes of the hermits as rapidly as possible. And in spite of his energetic signs, I passed the place at a distance of only about 50 yards. The magicians seemed to resent very greatly that I had disturbed the conjurations for which they had specially chosen the time of the day soon after sunset. They interrupted their sorceresses and approached in a threatening attitude, one of them actually swinging a katwamya, a tantric staff with not less than 3 human skulls fixed at the top. By that time I had met the most sinister forces of Tibet, black magicians and perhaps the whole world, so I did not feel uncomfortable at all when I saw all these magicians approach in a threatening manner. When they were quite near, I saw that they were almost furious and looked like so many dogs disturbed while taking their meal. The tantrikas almost snarled. They were what a Tibetan would call hana oni. I was not afraid of them. I knew that black magicians were not nearly so dreadful as the grey ones, viz. Those who gave themselves the outer appearance of angels and saviors. They surrounded me, each of them blowing a strong breath right into my face. May the Creator punish you for that, I thought, and remained standing motionless, merely concentrating all my soul power so as to counteract any possible tendency at dissociation of my personality. Suddenly one of the black magicians shouted in an agonized voice, "Chomden da," and they all took to their heels. They all ran away in wild terror and disappeared from sight as if a sudden apparition had emerged behind me, inspiring them with great fear. One of the blacks even left his katwamya behind, since these sticks are rather bulky and prevent fast running. I could never really find out why these tantrikas had taken to flight so suddenly. I am not aware of having done anything to inspire them with such terror. Night had fallen, but I decided to walk on in the extremely furious dark, although the countryside was very mountainous, and I fully realized the risk of doing so. I had to consider the alternative of capture if these reports about the district governor having heard of the presence of a white man were true. So I had the choice between 2 dangers of a different type, and decided to take my chances none of both. I should have done better to wait until daybreak instead of walking in the dark night in the mountainous district, which, as I found a little later, was a very foolish thing to do. I had not the faintest idea that I still had to pass through one of the most dreadful ordeals of my whole Tibetan journey before I reached my goal, the region inhabited by most of the wise hermits who stand for the Creator and isolate themselves in these districts not in order to get selfish bliss, but in a spirit of sacrifice to counteract in some measure the dreadful psychical currents set loose by the various saviors and the host of fallen angels incarnated in the flesh in Tibet. There may be a few such people even in Western countries, veritable guardian angels of humanity sometimes incarnated in heroes who counteract the pernicious working of certain saviors, but no spiritual being has a right to tell people who is a hero and who is the mouthpiece of fallen angels. Each one must discover this for himself. I walked on at top speed in the darkness. The moon had not yet risen, but the starlit sky showed the way and provided a very dim light, enabling me to avoid the worst precipices. How different had been the mildly undulating landscape in northern Tibet when Ksyukaru, the brigand boy, and I had been hunted by the robbers. As I had no blanket, I intended to walk on until sunrise and to sleep then until noon. Soon after midnight, while I was walking on a gentle slope, it seemed as if the whole ground on which I was moving began to give way in the darkness. A few seconds later I was swept down into the abyss. A portion of my equipment, including the bag containing most of my food, was torn away, while I somersaulted in tremendous bumps down the precipice. Having covered about 200 yards in this manner, the few seconds seeming to be as long as whole ages, I felt that the ground sloped less and less, and finally I came to a standstill. I was unable to move. Half of my clothes had been torn away while I had somersaulted across debris, and perhaps the eighth part of my skin had been lacerated while I progressed in this manner. I thought something had happened to my spine as I was unable to move my trunk. I also felt dreadful pain in my left foot. In this condition I lay on the ground with practically all my food lost and the night getting colder and colder. I knew I was 25 miles from the nearest human abode, and now had ample time to meditate on the risks of a solitary explorer who makes the mistake of walking in the mountains by night in uninhabited territories. For 2 days and two nights I lay paralyzed on the same spot, exposed to the scorching rays of the sun in the afternoon and to the bitter cold by night. I went through all the agonies of cold, thirst, and helplessness of a kind that seemed unendurable. I realized that even courage when it is carried to the point of foolhardiness may be a sin, and that it is not enough to avoid sinning against the Creator and against our neighbor, but that man also has obligations towards himself. Never before had I felt with such bitter intensity that there was also such a thing as sinning against one's self. But during those dreadful 2 days while I lay helpless in the mountains exposed to all kinds of material sufferings and mental agonies, I never blamed the Creator. "Thy will be done," I murmured. I had committed a sin against myself by exposing myself to danger without absolute necessity, and fully realized that I deserved punishment. As I lay there, forlorn and hopeless, with gushing wounds, I felt that my fate was enviable in comparison with those who had given their souls to the evil one. In all my self-caused misery I still was a child of the Creator, and in all my agony I never uttered the prayer of my God, "Take my sufferings away." I felt that the laws of the universe were just and that I could not importune the Creator with selfish prayers. I had caused my own dreadful predicament, and as a man I had to face the consequences of my blunder. I, the tiny creature, could not ask the Creator to violate the order of his universe and to modify his wise laws of absolutely just retribution in order to please me and take away from me the punishment I had so well deserved. After all, who was I, and who was the Creator? When I contemplated His Majesty I felt the distance which separated Him from His creatures. How can the creature fathom God? It would be like a butterfly trying to fathom the greatness of Shakespeare. The third day I found, with great joy, that I could move a little. The flesh wounds were healing rapidly, and in spite of the dreadful thirst, partly due to loss of blood, I began to feel stronger. A little later I found that my foot was on the mend. The fourth day I was strong enough to crawl. I still felt much pain in my left foot and could not stand upright, but I crawled along as fast as I could, resting most of my weight on my hands. Theta's tower I had covered 200 yards. The following hour the speed had increased to 250 yards. It was not much in comparison with the 20-odd miles still separating me from the abodes of the hermits, but it was better than nothing. I blessed the Creator for having spared me the worst. I might have also injured my hands in the accident, and fell asleep in an exhausted condition. Instead of wasting my strength by continually rubbing my body as I had done the previous nights, when I was unable to move in the bitter cold, I spent the fifth night crawling along at the rate of perhaps 600 yards an hour. With iron will power I kept it up practically all night, and then almost collapsed at daybreak. At noon I was on my way again, and in the afternoon I partly regained the use of my legs. The speed at which I now progressed seemed to me enormous. I covered nearly 1.5 miles per hour, and in the evening I shouted repeatedly. The sound of my voice loudly echoed back from the mountains. Every 5 or 10 minutes I shouted. In the great quiet of the atmosphere of Tibet, sound waves travel a long way, and I hoped that some of the hermits might hear me. The following day I advanced at a speed of nearly 2 miles an hour. Two hermits heard the faint sound of a human voice. When they found me, I had almost reached the limits of human resistance to cold, exposure, thirst, hunger, and fatigue. I had lost blood, too, but I felt that with an iron will I might still have carried on the struggle for another 24 hours before I definitely collapsed. The hermits, who were no soul snatchers this time, but strong and powerful individuals who were intensely personal and yet acted impersonally, took great care of me. They healed my wounds with almost miraculous rapidity, gave me new clothes, and a day later even recovered the sheepskin containing my rubber boat and a few other items of my equipment which had fallen over the precipice. They immediately put me on a special diet which seemed to be very strange to their patient, since it chiefly consisted of a kind of salad made of various medicinal plants and garlic. Ever since I had left the underground city, a strange cadaveric smell had clung to me. The hermits noticed the smell, which they said may have been due to magical operations by which a portion of the vitalizing principle of my physical body had been drawn away by black sorcerers and then decomposed by magical practices for the purpose of killing me. They said that since their practices had not succeeded in murdering me, my enemies had probably killed themselves in the effort. In the hands of these marvelous healers I recovered with extraordinary rapidity, and the third day after my arrival in the district I entered the abode of the brother of my friend who had procured me Tibetan clothes before I had entered the country. "You have gone through dreadful experiences," he said, immediately after having greeted me. "But had we warned you, you might have missed the greatest experience of your life." So he knew all about it. Must everyone discover spiritual values by passing through spiritual ordeals? I asked. "Yes," he replied. "This is inevitable, for man shapes his own destiny. Of course, the nature of the experiences varies in each case. I have become intensely soul-conscious now," I said, "and intensely eye-conscious. I hope you will not turn into an egotist," he observed smilingly. "No," I said. "An unreasonably high dose of egotism really denotes lack of personality. Although I am very personal now, I shall always work for the world without any thought of a spiritual reward. Animals whose whole energies in life are concentrated on the defense of their I have no personality at all. For lie consciousness is not necessarily brutality and selfishness. Men can be intensely personal and yet act quite impersonally. I intensely realized that the more man approaches full individualization, the more he is conscious of his duties to the Creator, the rising branch of life, and himself. The problem of the world is both an individual and a collective one. Man modifies his environment by his living example, and man in turn is influenced by his environment. The multitudes are largely a product of this environment, continually influenced and modified by dynamic personalities. In most cases, strong personalities are the real friends of mankind rather than those who recommend an absolutely uncompromising attitude leading to a futile attitude of spiritual and material suicide. The province of man is action. In this world of matter, which is really the battleground for a formidable struggle of two different spiritualities, the few wise men of Tibet who are great and dynamic personalities, intensely personal and yet acting impersonally, represent a kind of bodyguard of the Creator which holds in check the other camp of methodically working annihilators and soul snatchers. Can you perform miracles? I asked two other wise men who came to see us the following day. The three hermits smiled meaningly. I could feel their thoughts. They possessed the power to rule over the forces of nature, but their very nature prevented them from using those certain spiritual laws are inherent to the very nature of spiritual beings. Just as a man simply cannot eat stones or a tree, live in a place where sunshine never penetrates, spiritual beings cannot do the spiritual things which are contrary to their spiritual nature. Powers unless it was absolutely necessary in the service of the Creator. After a slight pause, one of the wise hermits asked me, suppose one of us performed a so-called miracle here before your eyes, would you take this as a proof of a divine mission? I have seen men flying, I answered. And I have seen the most dreadful types of sorcerers make dead bodies walk. I should take no miracle on earth as a proof of the divine will. The Creator has laid down his own wise laws ruling the universe. It is not he or his servants who break them. When I mentioned the word Creator, they all had tears in their eyes. Did they think of the dreadful spectacle of a world in open revolt against its maker? The end dot, end note. The reader will have realized that the term hermit is a very inadequate one in describing the few genuine Tibetan hermits who are not contemplative but dynamic beings. I have chosen the word hermit because they isolate themselves voluntarily in a spirit of sacrifice, but apart from this fact, the genuine hermits have none of the characteristics of devotion, contemplative bliss and meekness which a Westerner is accustomed to associate with the term hermit. The first authentic and fully detailed account of an underground city in Tibet by the only Westerner ever to visit there and come back to tell about it. While traveling in disguise in Tibet in the early 1930s, Leon made some chance acquaintances which led to contacts with an occult fraternity and an invitation to visit the underground city. There he had some truly remarkable experiences, which are recorded in this book. His previous book, In Secret Tibet, recounts meeting with wise hermits. This book, he says, supplements In Secret Tibet by showing a different side of the picture, a few demons of the light and many demons of the shadow. The German traveler Theodor Leon was one of the first travelers to penetrate Tibet while it was still sealed off from the outside world. These rare and exciting travel classics are now back to read. Remark also it has audio in Danish on this, plus audio on the other book, Secret Tibet, all MP3 files to download.